Hi there, Brett Worthington with you for a Country Breakfast here on RN. Tapping into China has long been the main game for Australian farmers keen to secure new markets. From meat to nuts, dairy to fruit, securing market access is a long and complicated venture. But there's little sympathy for those complaining about the hurdles they're having to jump over.
I mean, the sort of people that are complaining to me, Australians, who are going up there and finding they've got to register things and, you know, get approvals and meet food standards. And I say, you're the very same person who's been telling me for 30 years, you know, when I was in public life, don't you dare let any product come from overseas which doesn't meet our standards.
The hypocrisy of trade, that's to come. To get things underway though, Kath McAloon has a wrap of the week's big stories. Kath, what's been sparking your interest this week?
Well, I think guess we can't go past Cyclone Debbie this week, which really devastated areas of North Queensland. Debbie moved pretty slowly, but she was pretty ferocious. And in her wake, she just left, I guess, a lot of water. It rained for days up in parts of Queensland. And that made it really hard for farmers to get out and see just what destruction there was on their farms and just how badly they'd fared from that cyclone. Many farmers weren't able to get onto their farms just because of the water inundation and roads being closed because of flooding. But from what they have seen so far, they know that many crops have suffered severe damage and it's going to be pretty expensive for farmers. It's not just crops, though, that have been affected. Tony Mars from the National Farmers Federation, and he says that farmers are also going to have to deal with the prospect of a lot of their infrastructure also being destroyed.
Dwellings, sheds, fences, storage facilities, roads, that if we are going to get what remains of the produce out of the ground to market, then floodwaters can have a significant effect on getting that those products to supermarket shelves.
We've heard lots of expressions like it's the salad bowl, it's the veggie bowl. So lots of winter vegetables are being produced up there. Lots of different regions as well. Sugarcane's affected. From the vegetable front, though, what have you been hearing?
Yeah, well, it's understood that the Bowen region is among the worst hit region. And that region does produce, as you say, a lot of those fruit and veggie things like capsicums, tomatoes, beans. It is referred to as the salad bowl. And there are concerns now that we could see in coming months, because a lot of these areas were doing their winter plantings, but that's sort of been put to the side for now. So there's concerns that we could see in a couple of months possible shortages. And there's also concerns about what the impact of that will be on prices throughout the country. Steve Schmidt is a fruit and veggie wholesaler based in Mackay in that region. And he expects that supply will be scarce in the next month to 2 months. And he says that will drive the prices higher.
Our industry is based on supply and demand. And that's going to have a major impact. Our prices will be moving up. If you consider the product, the main staple lines which come out of the Bowen, Burdekin areas there, capsicums, tomatoes, beans, and the list goes on, yeah, it will affect all consumers.
So while it's still a little bit uncertain, I guess, just what those effects will be for consumers and just, I guess, how the farmers are going to get on, we have heard this week, though, that there is disaster assistance available for farmers. So the federal and state governments have this sort of joint program of concessional loans and also loans for essential working capital and also freight subsidies. So some of that money's already been made available to producers in the Whitsunday and Mackay regional council areas. And so there were those areas there was really significant damage to horticultural crops, the sugar cane, also some irrigation equipment, which is really expensive to fix, and also infrastructure for cane trains. So some money getting its way to those producers.
It's one that there's lots of photos from right across all different parts of the ABC. We'll put them on our website and people can click there and have a look through. But I think, like you say, it's going to be a long way to recover from what's been going on. Moving away from Debbie, animal cruelty has again been back in the headlines this week. What's been going on?
Yeah, well, this is interesting. There's this case that's been ongoing for a couple of years now. Last month, three shearers in the Western Victorian region pleaded guilty to animal cruelty charges. And these were charges that stemmed from an undercover investigation that the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, the PETA group, did in that region a few years ago. What's happened this week, though, is the men were to appear in court on Friday for the sentencing. They've already pleaded guilty. But a bit of controversy sprung up when a billboard targeting drug use and animal cruelties was appeared in the area. So Peter took out this advertising banner just on the outskirts of Horsham, which is where the court case was heard and where the men were due in court for their sentencing. And the banner reads, "Shearing and drugs don't mix. Always report animal abuse." It features the gaunt face of a man besides the words, "Dave has been up on ice for 3 days. Shearing and drugs don't mix." Now, this has created a bit of a stir because these shearers who did plead guilty to animal cruelty charges, there was no allegation that they were taking drugs. That wasn't part of this case. And so local shearer Jamie Tippett says that this billboard is really unfair.
Definitely has a negative impact, especially on a small community. Like, these guys have already been through hell for the last 3 years. They've been punished, and now this is just the icing on the cake for them.
Interestingly, with this case, it's the Shearing Contractors Association, which has been coming out and really pushing to weed out this abuse that's happening in the sheds. They feel like they're making gains into that area. And I know there were studies last year looking at drug use in sheds, but I imagine they're a bit disappointed with how this is all fed.
Just because of the personal aspect of these particular men. And they're saying, you know, it isn't a problem in our industry. It's a problem in a lot of industries. But they're saying it's not fair when you've got this case and the timing is so specific. Peter's spokesperson on this, Laura Wayman Jones, said that the aim of the billboard was to send a clear message to the industry. She doesn't think it's negative asking people to report animal and drug abuse. And she was sort of saying, you know, Horsham was targeted because it's a shearing hub and it's a hub for the wool industry, and they wanted people to see it as they drove around town.
I'm sure it's getting lots of talk right across the country, not just in Horsham at the moment. So I guess it's been quite successful from Peter's point of view. But the wool industry more generally is going through a big phase of lots of focus being put on it from animal welfare standards.
Yeah, and a bit of a perennial issue for the industry is the issue of mulesing. It's one that we talk about a lot. It pops up a lot for the industry. And now there's renewed efforts to convince the wool industry that they really need to prepare for a future without mulesing. There's been some really big high-profile anti-mulesing campaigns in recent years. Mulesing is, of course, where lambs have the skin removed from their hind legs and buttocks. It's done so that the area doesn't sort of get a bit manky with, attracting flies to that region. Exactly. But it is viewed by parts of the broader community as a cruel practice. The use of pain relief for this procedure has increased, but some still are really calling for it to be banned completely. It's starting to be phased out, but it's still something that occurs in the industry. And now there's a warning that with consumers being more and more interested in where their clothes come from, in how they're produced, and wool growers really rely on that premium. They sort of sell themselves as a clean and green sort of ethical industry. And so they're vulnerable to these campaigns from activists who want to highlight this practice. Professor Graham Martin is from the Institute of Agriculture at the Uni of Western Australia. And he says that issues like mulesing, also issues like methane emissions, are tarnishing that ethical image for wool and that shoppers are demanding. And he says the industry really risks getting caught unprepared if they don't do something.
Australian farmers now have been using mulesing for decades, and you know they haven't really got their head around what will happen if they can no longer do it. You know, if we're not prepared and if we're not working steadily towards the goal, we will be surprised and everybody will be hurt. So I'm really concerned that we don't move fast enough.
Particularly when you've seen some fashion houses saying they're only going to source wool that's come from, that they feel is ethically treated. It'll be interesting to see how the industry deals with this. I think burying your head in the sand probably won't solve one. Another perennial issue is GM crop. From a grain growing point of view, it's canola is the main game. What have we been hearing this week?
This is a really interesting development this week, Brett. You can put away the fish oil, you can stop eating those tins and tins of tuna, because we may soon be able to get our omega-3 needs through canola. So this is the latest kind of GM canola crop that's being developed at the moment. It's a high omega-3 canola variety, and they're hoping that it will become the major land-based source of that important omega-3 nutrient, which is very popular among health-conscious people. So that high demand for omega-3 is actually putting pressure on fish stocks. So now New Seeds, which is a subsidiary of the New Farm Company, is hoping that its genetically modified canola variety will be available to farmers by 2018 that will have this higher level of omega-3. Brent Zacharias is the group executive with that group. He says if it's approved by the gene technology regulator, it'll be the first canola variety that's been modified for nutritional qualities rather than resistance to herbicides.
Yeah, there's really four key markets that we see as being important places for the end use of the oil that results from the grain from our omega-3 seed. It's pharmaceutical markets, nutraceutical markets, use in human food, as well as aquaculture for feed.
The backpacker tax last year prompted lots of the horticulture groups to come out and say they were concerned that their workforce would disappear because of that uncertainty. I know in Northern Victoria earlier in the year we heard with summer fruits there was a lack of workers. It's now really coming into the apple season. What are we hearing from the apple growers?
Yeah, well, some reports starting to come in from around the country that apple growers are having a really tough season. In central west New South Wales, so around the Orange area, there's a couple of issues which are compounding. One is the kind of weird weather that they've been having. They had a really wet spring and now they've had a really hot March, and that's created a few problems for growing, making it a challenging season. But growers in that region say the biggest issue that they've been facing is this really severe shortage of workers. Picking is now underway in that area. Most growers are confident that they will get a good harvest, but it hasn't been easy going. They've had to sort of, you know, juggle picking around worker availability. Bernard Hall's a grower in that region. He has 40,000 trees not far out of Orange. He says the shortage of workers has been tough, and he blames it on that uncertainty over the tax rate for backpackers.
It's been incredibly hard this year. We've been big borrowing steel from whoever we can and short of sharing. If I finish a variety, I'll just check with my neighbour and see if he needs someone. We sort of work in pretty good with neighbours, but it has been the toughest year we've had for a while looking for pickers, and I suppose it all stems back from the lack of decision making earlier in the season.
And also hearing reports from Tasmania. Phil Pike is with Fruit Growers Tasmania, and he's saying that many growers there are seeing big shortage of workers. One in particular is short 60 pickers for their apple growing season.
One of the major farms up in the Tamar had enough pickers. They have a break of a few days and go on to start picking their Golden Delicious, and all of a sudden they're down 15 because they've moved straight to the wine sector.
The latest Khaleesi virus strain felt like it was a long time coming. There was lots of talking and hope about what it would do. It is out there now. Researchers are keeping an eye on how it's faring, I understand.
Yeah, it's having an impact already on feral rabbit populations. They're starting to find dead rabbits near some of the baiting stations that were set up across the country at the start of March. So they're turning up in a few places. There was some opposition to this. There was a petition of about 15,000 people opposed to it, but those rolling it out say that it's being welcomed by those working to conserve the native habitat. And the virus will still need to be used in conjunction with other control techniques. So far, there's only been sort of a couple of dead rabbits found, but it's sort of a bit of a spiralling effect now, because that carcass of the dead rabbit that's taken the Khaleesi virus, it then continues to emit the virus. So it becomes a bit of a bomb, I guess, and it goes back to the warren, and then it sort of rolls out and out from there. So it's expected that there'll be sort of blanket coverage now within just a couple of months. That's how quickly it will spread. Dr. Tanya Cox is from the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, and she's saying it'll take a bit of time to collate all the information, but so far the signs are good.
While everybody wants an answer straight away, this is actually the waiting game. While people look for dead rabbits, collect all of their samples and then send them in, and then they get assessed, that process can take weeks, just simply due to postage and the time it takes to find dead rabbits. Because I know that people are still looking, and those samples are trickling in.
I think the next big cull will be probably carp in the Murray River. I know lots of people looking at that. And again, you'll have this same issue where you have carcasses everywhere, and working out what to do with that waste will obviously be
a
smelly task, I guess, for those
the rotting fish smell.
Yeah. Let's head west. There's some interesting news coming out with to do with solar and energy use that's happening.
Yeah, I guess renewable energy has probably been a bit of an issue in the news for the last couple of months. And now a remote fertiliser company, which is based in the Gibson Desert in Western Australia, so you'd think it would be a prime place for capturing some solar power.
Yeah.
They're aiming to generate 70% of their energy use from solar. Agrimin Limited owns a sulfate of potash project at Lake Mackay on the WA Northern Territory border. So it's in a fairly isolated region there. And they use most of their energy to heat water, which is then used to turn the potash into fertiliser. So it's a pretty ambitious project. The chief executive of this company is Mark Savage, and he says that using the solar thermal technology will reduce their costs and their reliance on traditional sources of energy.
The reality is the more we can move ourselves away from being dependent on not only fossil fuels, but also on third parties such as gas providers and gas pipeline providers, and towards something that we have control of, that's really where we want to go.
Kath, thank you.
Thanks, Brett.
Let's now head out with our rural reporters. This week we're off to the Barossa Valley to meet a very, very busy farmer. Not content to just grow grapes, Jamie Nitschke also runs a full-time dairy. We introduce you to Jim Young. He caught the collecting bug 4 years ago and now has more than 100 old sewing machines housed in a purpose-built shed. There's just one problem. He doesn't know how to sew. And we'll head to the Northern Territory where a group of young ringers are getting their first taste of life in the top end.
I thought there was going to be crocodiles everywhere I went. I just assumed everywhere there was water there'd be crocodiles.
Oh, I heard it's pretty wild and good fun. And I know it's completely different to home, completely out of my depth.
Oh, I know that feeling. First impressions of life in the north a little later today. But let's start our travels in South Australia's Barossa Valley, where the Nitschkes are continuing a proud family tradition.
Yeah, so we're just getting into vintage now. So we started grape picking last week. This week's pretty quiet, but next week will probably be more full on again.
Jamie Nitschke is a very, very busy man, but it's not just this year's vintage he's thinking about. This grape grower from South Australia's Barossa Valley also runs a dairy farm at his Moffat Estate vineyard, producing up to 4,000 litres of milk a day. Hello, I'm Courtney Fowler. Jamie Nitschke and his wife Annalise are following a proud family tradition of mixed farming on this Kanunga property. And while he admits it's a hard slog at times, it's a tradition that's worked seamlessly for more than 50 years.
When I'm milking here, usually starts probably about 5:15 to get the cows in, so that we can make sure we start milking by 6:00. So that goes for probably a bit over an hour, the actual milking. And then there's cleaning up and feeding. And so then we have breakfast after that and then head off to the other jobs for the day. So sometimes during the year it'll be vineyard work. Sometimes it could be just feeding more stock. This time of year there's a lot of feeding to do, a lot of fencing, and always something to fix, it seems. So.
With such a busy schedule to keep, it's hard to believe that the Nitschkes actually have scaled back their farming operation in recent years. Previously, they also ran sheep and grew apricots here, but now they just concentrate on the grapes and the dairy.
So we're milking around 200 cows all year round. So we've got cows calving pretty much every week and cows going dry all the time. So that we can maintain an even production year round, because we're predominantly supplying into the liquid milk market, and everyone likes to have their lattes and cappuccinos all year round, so they're always going to need milk. And we also supply the Barossa Valley Cheese Company with their total requirements, which is just a small boutique local company. We've always been supplying them since they started. The minimum we'd produce is about 4,000 litres a day, and that probably goes up to around 5,000 litres a day when we've got plenty of fresh cows and plenty of green grass. So generally, if we start grape picking, if we're hand picking, we'll start that at 7:00 in the morning. That'll go through till probably about 4:00, and then we actually start milking again at 4:00 in the afternoons. And my father still comes out of his semi-retirement to milk cows for me, and I have to deliver grapes to the winery or those sorts of jobs as well. So, yeah.
My goodness. With milking over for the morning, it's time for Jamie Nitschke to head out to the vineyard to check on the grapes.
Yeah, so this section of vineyard here is all alternative varieties, so basically less common varieties in Australia anyway. And we've got Graciano here at the moment, then there's Durif or Petit Syrah in the middle, and up the other end is a variety from Soviet Georgia called Saparavi.
All right, let's park up and take a look. When you're looking at the grapes and you're picking them, I mean, how do you know that they're ready? Are these ones here hand-picked or are they with a harvester?
So these will be done by a machine. We do sample the grapes weekly for Bome, which is the sugar level, and also for to test for the acid and pH level as well. Ideally, the wineries are looking for probably 14.5 Bome. We sell all our grapes on. Probably about 80% is sold to Treasury Wine Estates for the Penfolds label, and certainly that's Australia's most famous wine, and consequently they can also pay us the highest price provided that we can make the grade. So certainly with our Shiraz, our aim is to get into Grange, which we do from time to time, but it's always a challenge to make sure you reach the peak, and that certainly is the pinnacle, I guess, of grape growing quality in Australia.
You mentioned that at 7 o'clock you go do some hand picking. So which varieties require hand picking? Are they your higher quality grapes?
It really depends on the block. So some blocks aren't set up for machines, and Tempranillo, for example, although is trellised well for machine, it's very, very brittle, and the wood will break really easily. So it does lend itself better for hand picking. We have some really old vines as well. So some of our Shiraz would be 100 plus years old. So you wouldn't dare run a machine over them because they're old and brittle like old bones, but they produce really good quality. And we also do have one block which is still bush vines, which is the old traditional system before they used trellis, and so that there's no option there but to hand pick those.
Successfully working a dairy farm and a vineyard isn't a job that would suit everyone, but for Jamie Nitschke, it's a way of life that won't be changing anytime soon.
No, probably not. I guess I've grown up here. Probably if you didn't grow up with this sort of system, or with dairy especially, it's not something you'd really aspire to be involved in, because it does tie you down a bit. But it's what I know, and it's we've learnt over the years to flourish, I guess, in the ground that we've been planted in, as the vines have. And so, we stick with it, and at the moment it's been serving us quite well.
The Barossa is definitely known for its Shiraz, but maybe not for its dairy. Do you like to surprise people with that fact that you produce a lot of our local milk for the farmer's own brand?
Well, wine and cheese goes really well together, so we think it's a great fit. And so, we're proud to have something, I guess, a little bit different. There's only a select few of us dairy farmers left in the Barossa region, and we're proud to be part of the industry, and look forward to a long future in it.
This is just a rainwater tank that we've actually cut down to size. So we've insulated it to try and keep it cooler in summer and warmer in winter. The native perch that we've got like a certain temperature. They don't like it too cold, or they don't like it too hot.
I'm surrounded by fruit trees, vegetables by the dozen. There's fresh chilies and herbs, and even some turkeys and chickens in the background. Then, of course, there's the fish, the silver perch, swimming lazily around in their tank. Hello, I'm Brooke Neindorf, and you could be forgiven for thinking I'm on a farm with lots of room to spread around. But no, in fact, I'm in a regular backyard in the South Australian regional town of Whyalla, where Jenny Sleep and her family have embraced the concept of urban farming and aquaponics. And they have a daughter with a fussy appetite to thank for it all.
It all started because basically my daughter is a fussy eater and she does not like vegetables. So we started growing out of wine barrels and growing our own salad type vegetables. And then as we started to sort of research better methods of, I guess, producing our own goods, it got to the stage where we started to get into the aquaponics because of, I guess, the benefits involved in it. If you come along to here, we've got some bins that we've purchased. No specialty items. swivel filters. So what it does is basically the fish poo. It gets sucked out from the bottom of the tank and put into these. Over time, these actually, the solids float down to the bottom and they mineralise in there and break down. And that is basically the fertiliser for the rest of the system. So it travels through the pipework. Most of the stuff that we've used here is recycled, with the exception of the polypipe. We've purchased most of that new. We've got 7 beds here at the moment. We've got 6 media beds that have got the clay balls. And we're just trialling this floating raft bed at the moment to see how it goes. Okay, we've got in this bed here, we've got some broccoli. So that's full. The good thing about aquaponics is in this area here, off the top of my head, I think there's 16 broccoli in there. We've also got two chili plants and a cucumber. So that's in about a metre square. You can grow almost, depending on what you plant, 30 times more in the same amount of space in an aquaponics than what you can in a traditional bed.
Why is that?
It's because of the nutrients in the build-up. So over there we've got broccoli as well, and we've got 8 plants in about the same area. It's just that with that, you sort of, in the traditional beds, you still need to constantly feed them. We don't use any pesticides in our system at all. It's all organic, only for the fact that it'll kill the fish. So not only do we use no pesticides in the aquaponics, we use no pesticides in the backyard at all. It's about a 28-day process for basically when the fish do their business for it to actually break down into something worthwhile. So,
and I can see some strawberries over there as well. So yeah, a few of those, and leeks or onions or something over there.
Spring onions there. So we grow also chilies in there, plus our herbs. In the far bed, we've got some corn, trialling that. That's our first trial with corn in the aquaponics. So we've got some tomatoes in 3 Dutch buckets at the moment. We've got some of the rainbow char as well. And we've also got kale coming up, which is a winter vegetable. But we're growing it in summer in the aquaponics. And obviously the chili plants as well. Also, the turnaround time for some of the veggies is quite quick. Our lettuce that we grow, we can grow from seed to actually producing food onto the table with 6 to 8 weeks, depending on the year. So the time, I guess, behind that turnaround is a lot quicker as well.
And are you just growing it for yourself, or do you sell it elsewhere?
Mainly, most of the stuff that we grow at the moment, we grow for ourselves, except for the chilies. I actually am about to start producing. I've gone through council for my approval. Chili sauces, like a chili gourmet range of chutney sauces, different types, right from, we grow everything from a mild capsicum to the world's hottest chili. So yeah, we do that. So I'm just about to venture into that, I guess.
And I guess the all-important question, you started this because your daughter was a fussy eater, so what's her eating habits like now?
It's improving.
Getting
she,
there.
Yeah, she gets there. She does try new things. Sometimes her taste buds aren't the greatest, but I've got a son who will basically eat anything out of our garden, so that's a good thing.
World's hottest chili?
No. I would not do that to my children. Might to my husband, but not my children.
Jenny Sleep from Waiala, getting a fussy eater to enjoy her veggies and grow some chilies on the side. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. Brett Worthington with you this morning. Still to come today, first impressions of life on a vast cattle station in the Northern Territory, and we meet a sewing machine collector who can't sew.
I got interested in when I was a young fella, because Mum used to make all our clothes, and I used to sit there and watch her make them on an old treadling machine, and I used to fix up the belt when it broke for every now and then, but I was intrigued then. And then when she passed away a few years ago, she left me a little hand machine, and I gave that to a friend of ours who was a very avid sewer. And then I thought I'd love to start collecting machines myself.
Do you know how to sew? Perhaps you've got a machine at home. Well, Jim Young from Mount Isa in northwest Queensland has plenty of machines at his disposal. There's just one problem. He doesn't know how to use any of them. Hi, I'm Zara Margolis. Jim only started collecting 4 years ago, but already has more than 100 old treadle machines lovingly housed in a purpose-built shed at the back of his house. He got the bulk of them from a fellow collector in Ipswich.
So I bought a few on eBay and around the traps, and I've come in contact with this guy down in Ipswich. Walked in his house, and from the front door to the back door and every space in between in his whole house was full of these sewing machines, all very collectible ones. And he explained to me that his health was failing and he had to move into a nursing home. So that's why he was starting to sell them all. So I was there for half the day looking at all these machines, and I bought half a dozen of them. And on the way home, driving home back to Brisbane, I said to Robin, I think I should buy the lot, because it's a ready-made collection. He had about 75 machines sitting there, all old and very rare ones. So I rang him up and said, work out a price. So we came to an agreement. I ended up buying his whole collection, I think.
Can I ask, was it a big blow to the hip pocket?
It was around $100,000 I paid for them. Yeah. You take that one, for instance. It's supposedly the only one in the world. It's called the Empress of India. It was made over in the United States. So it's the only one in the world.
And Jim didn't stop there. He's continued to buy the vintage sewing machines and now has 120 in his collection.
Well, my oldest one is about 155 years old. It's an 1862 model. It's a treadle machine. It's in a lovely cabinet. They've said only the very rich people would have been able to buy them at those times because it's a lovely piece of furniture at the time.
Do you have a favourite?
I do. There's a little one there that Mel Brosnan, a local black here, it was his mother's, and I see him down the pub every now and then, and I told him I collect sewing machines. He said, I've got one there from Mum. He said, you can have it. So he brought it around and gave it to me. And that's my little favourite. It's a lovely little Singer 99 machine. It's in perfect condition.
And you do have a lot of Singers, which for people who aren't familiar with the sewing scene, that's a very well-known brand. Are they all Singers?
No, they're not all Singers. They're from all over the world. There's American, there's English, there's a lot of Singers there, but I've got a German one, one or two German ones. I've got a French one. So they're all over the world. Yeah.
So do they still work?
They do.
Have you tried using them?
I don't sew, so if anybody's going to try them out, it'll have to be my wife.
So the sewing machine collector who doesn't sew, how do you explain that to people?
Well, I just like the machinery side of it. I think, you know, it's a real bloke thing. It's everyone's different how they work. And it's just intriguing how they all work and how they've been made so long ago.
Do people find it surprising when they meet you, Jim, who previously worked in the automotive business and things, and find out that you're also, well, not an avid sewer, but an avid sewing machine fan?
Yes, I get some very strange looks off some of my mates down at the pub, and they say, hey. Well, as you can see, there's a collection of oil cans there, little metal oil cans, the old Singer ones.
Jim hasn't stopped at treadle sewing machines. His collection also includes bobbins and reels and other sewing paraphernalia.
Well, I've collected oil bottles and oil cans and cotton reels and all that sort of stuff. You know, I've got some stuff there that I was going to put on the machines, the cotton reels with cotton. They're all made of timber. And the new ones are all made of plastic, so the old ones are all timber. And so they're getting a bit rare too, so I bought packets of them. But I decided they look so rare themselves, I left them in the packets. They're a collector's item as well. But anything to do with sort of sewing, my mum-in-law gave me a collection of her thimbles, for instance, up there. So, well, anything associated with sewing, I collect.
What do you think you'll do with the collection when it comes a time that you no longer have a need for it?
I don't know. I've pondered over that a fair bit. Thinking about leaving it to a museum somewhere or leaving it to someone that really cares, that would take on, keep collecting or adding to it or looking after it. You know, my good friend, she's a very avid sewer and I know she would look after it, so maybe that's where it's going to end up.
I thought there was going to be crocodiles everywhere I went. I just assumed everywhere there was water there'd be crocodiles.
Oh, I heard it's pretty wild and good fun. And I don't know, it's completely different to home, completely out of my depth. I guess if I'm going to spend a gap year or even if I do decide to stay, learn new skills is probably the best way around it.
Kelsey Ma and William Fagan have just spent their first week in the Northern Territory, a long way from their homes in the central west of New South Wales. They're just two of 23 new ringers who signed up to work on cattle stations owned by the Consolidated Pastoral Company, one of Australia's largest beef producers. G'day there, I'm Dan Fitzgerald. Some of the recruits are straight out of school on the lookout for adventure, while others have worked on family properties down south and are now keen to experience life on a vast cattle station in the north. They spent a week induction training here at Mamberloo Station near Katherine, being put through training in cattle handling, horse riding, first aid and general maintenance. They'll then head out to cattle stations spread out across northern Australia.
My name's Kelsey Ma, I'm from Oberon, New South Wales. Ever since I've been about 10, 11 years old, it's something I've always wanted to do and I've just stuck with it and finally done it when I finished school.
And how do you see the beef industry going at the moment?
Yeah, good. Really good, I think. It's getting a lot bigger, it's growing pretty rapid and a lot more jobs coming and a lot more people getting interested in it and stuff.
How do you see opportunities for your career going forward?
I think this is a massive opportunity. We've been told there's people that have started out as cooks on stations and now they're managing places, so I think the list of opportunities is pretty much endless of just whatever we put our minds to up here we can pretty much do. So,
are you hoping to stay in the beef industry long term?
Yeah, I'm planning on like doing my first year and then depending on how much I love it or don't love it, go home for another year. But I'm loving it already, so I'd say I'd be up here for a while.
William Fagan, I'm from Orange in New South Wales. I was really interested about live export and the beef industry, and I thought, oh, it's a good stepping stone, it'll be good fun, and whatever move I'd take next would be good, like a good stepping stone.
What's some of your first impressions you've had of the territory?
Spacious, a fair bit of room between places. It looks really good at the moment, but I think we've had an extraordinary wet season, so that's partly to blame for it. But yeah, it's sort of completely different to home. Flat. I'm from real hilly country.
What experience have you had in the ag industry?
I was brought up on a property just outside of Orange. We ran sheep and cows and a bit of cropping and a lot of hay making. I was involved in the school's cattle team, and that's really got me into a lot of places, and that's been the best part about the whole. Like, that's been my best move so far, and now it's set me up for this adventure.
What are you hoping for your time in the territory here?
Well, to ride horses first, because I'm pretty hopeless at that. But I'd like to also learn heaps of skills, network, meet heaps of people in the industry, because there's a lot of big people up here, and they're the people you want to know if you want to go far. And oh, it's just going to be a good time, I reckon. Bit hot, though.
And how has your horse riding been going? We've got your horse right here with us.
I've had a few close calls this morning. Still pretty green on it. I've only been riding for, well, a half day, and plus a little bit more when I did a lesson at home, but that was about it. So hopefully it gets better from here, I'll tell you in a while.
Kelly Carson comes from Dirranbandi in southwest Queensland, where her parents have a sheep and cattle property. But she's quickly adapting to life in the top end.
I was expecting hard work, hot weather, just some interesting people and characters, yeah.
And your few days so far, has it lived up to that?
Yeah, it's been very humid, good work ethic, fun times and lovely people, so.
What's your background in the ag industry?
I grew up on a cattle and sheep property west of Dirranbandi. I grew up with cattle and sheep, so had a lot to do helping the family and mum and dad.
So why did you choose to come up to the territory and work for a big cattle company like CPC?
Oh, I just wanted to be involved in something different, and CPC had a great reputation for good work ethic and great teamwork, so I really wanted to be involved in something like that. So yeah, and definitely a change of scenery working with, you know, different sort of cattle. Yeah.
What's something you're really looking forward to when you get out to Newry Station?
Just getting involved and probably learning as much as I can. They have a different way of working with cattle and everything compared to home, so it's just going to be a very interesting, new, fresh look on handling cattle and production, stuff like that.
Harvey Misford has probably travelled the furthest to get here. He's come all the way from Warrnambool in Victoria for the job.
Well, I've always wanted to do it since I was younger, and I was down home doing another job for the last couple of years, and I thought, well, now's the time, or else I won't get time to do it, so I thought, just come up here. So,
why do you want to work in the beef industry?
I grew up on a beef farm and a dairy farm, so I've always had an interest in cattle, and there's a lot of opportunities in the beef industry, so just see how far I can go with it.
What do you hope to achieve from it?
Yeah, well, with my career, I'd eventually like to own my own place, run my own cattle, run my own show, so that's the end goal.
What station will you be heading to after this induction week?
Avern, which is about 3.5 hours away.
Do you know anything about it at the moment?
Avern. I was reading on the internet, apparently they send off 30,000 head of cattle a year off just that one station, so it's a pretty big operation.
And how does that compare to Victoria, where you're from?
The scale's just not even, you're not even comparing apples with apples, it's massive up here, so.
Harvey Misford, a long way from his hometown of Warrnambool in southwest Victoria, just one of the new ringer recruits taken on by Consolidated Pastoral in the Northern Territory. Dan Fitzgerald caught up with them at Katherine. You're with A Country Breakfast. I'm Brett Worthington. Shortly, we'll head to a small Victorian beach town where tensions are rising between tourists and locals.
It's usually too many Asians here.
So you get frustrated with the amount of people getting pippies on this beach?
Yes. Yep, definitely. Yeah.
Why is that?
There's nothing left. There's no big ones left. So, yeah.
We're off to Venus Bay very shortly, but up next, we're cracking open the nut industry.
We're in the midst of an information war, and social media platforms like Facebook are on the front line.
I think Zuckerberg got a bit of a shock when he wrote that post a week after the election saying, oh, fake news didn't have an impact. 3 weeks ago, here's my 6,000-word post. Like, he's definitely on a journey.
They're the new news gatekeepers, but can they stop the spread of fake news? And what can you do to combat it? Big Ideas with me, Paul Barclay, on the ABC Radio app or where you get your favourite podcasts.
Australia's agriculture sector has kept a strong focus on China for years now, producing a range of wild successes and more than a few failures. This week in Melbourne, what the Chinese consumer wants was the big focus of two major food and agricultural conferences. Our reporter Clint Jasper attended the Global Food Forum and the Nut Industry Conference, where he found a familiar message was being delivered to exporters across the board, hoping for success in China.
Free from having to toe the party line, former Federal Trade Minister Andrew Robb had a message for Australian businesses complaining about Chinese regulations.
They've got a right to insist on certain food standards. They got caught out with all of the e-commerce. I mean, all this stuff started happening and there were no regulations. I mean, the sort of people that are complaining to me, Australians, who are going up there and finding they've got to register things and, you know, get approvals and meet food standards. And I say, you're the very same person who's been telling me for 30 years, you know, when I was in public life, don't you dare let any product come from overseas which doesn't meet our standards.
He told the Australian newspaper's Global Food Forum in Melbourne that small and medium-sized food exporters were far outperforming their larger peers.
Most of what's happening at the moment has been driven by small and medium business through e-commerce, etc. The big companies, I can't believe how many of them have got no brands whatsoever. And I don't like name names, but some of our very big food producers and things.
The biggest platform for e-commerce in China is Alibaba, where sales figures during promotions like the famous November Singles Day reach mind-boggling proportions. The Australian Macadamia Society's marketing manager Lynn Zilke says the industry has been seeing strong sales through the online platforms like Tmall, Alibaba and JD.com.
Online is a really interesting emerging channel and it really changes the dynamics of consumption as well. So previously most consumption was around Chinese New Year, so just after Christmas, our Christmas. But now online really spreads that consumption right across the year.
Including days like Singles Day, which China Ag Market Director Loren Puet says is perfectly timed for the nut industry.
They're very important. Not only do these holidays, they sell a lot of nuts, but they also coincide with the major harvest seasons of these nuts. So, you know, it matches up in terms of supply and demand in that linkage. But also, it's just a new market. It's a good way to introduce, new varieties of nuts, whether it's, it undergoes some type of processing. But it's just a big market, it's just a new way to introduce, and more people are using their mobile phones and laptops to make these purchases, so it's a new way to retail as well.
Alibaba's Director of Business Development for Australia and New Zealand, John O'Loughlin, says Australian food companies stand to gain big from these promotions.
Year on year, international product went from under 20% to over 34% of consumption on the Tmall platform in just a single year. So I think that the leadership in Hangzhou are excited about these international brands.
Trading in China generally comes with pitfalls. Last year, a host of stock market darlings were taken by surprise when the Chinese government announced it would require products to be re-registered for sale through its online marketplaces. And it proposed adding a tax to those sales. The A2 Milk Company's Peter Nathan says his company was more resilient than others because its products move through the Daigou channel of private shoppers and they keep a close eye on inventory levels.
So from our perspective, a lot of our business had been going very seamlessly through the Daigou channel, which is a legitimate channel. It's fully taxed and it's a legitimate channel in its own right. So from that perspective, you know, the cross-border e-commerce changes were welcomed, but they weren't a major event for us.
Daigous were a source of controversy in 2015 when supplies of infant formula began to dwindle on local supermarket shelves. But Albert Zee, whose private equity firm Wattle Hill's an investor in Bubs Baby Food and Budgerim Ginger, says they'll remain a vital cog in the export machine to China.
There's a million Chinese in Australia, so WeChat, it's instantaneous. Chinese consumers are looking for what Australians are eating because they buy our lifestyle. And Daigous are very important to that. And I think, you know, that's never going to go away.
Loren Puet from China Ag Market agrees the lifestyle factor is a valuable selling point in China for all exporters.
The Almond Board of California, they initially tried to market their nuts as, it's a healthy nut. But that's kind of understood within the Chinese market based on their experience with walnut, because people know it's good for your brain, it's good for your heart. So what they had to do is change their tack and instead focus on marketing California itself, which is something Australia can do itself, because California is perceived within Chinese culture as being a clean environment, very natural, and so is Australia. And so what they're doing is marketing almond, not so much that it's healthy, but that it's, you're eating a piece of the supplying country, if you will, something that's healthy, natural. So, and yes, it's a little bit of a status symbol, especially among the young, but, it's just based on that imagery of the nut itself, where it comes from.
Albert C says the Australian stock market's reaction to the announcement that China would indefinitely delay its e-commerce changes was a sign there's still much more work to do with engaging the Chinese market.
The announcement about e-commerce delay in implementation or suspension of the implementation was announced on Friday afternoon in China. But it wasn't until Tuesday the stock prices in Australia started going up by more than 10%. I think Australians as general don't actually get up-to-date information from China as quickly as we should. That news should be out on the Saturday morning paper. It should be reflected in the share price on Monday.
Despite the challenges and the speed bumps, Australia's agriculture industry's eye remains firmly on China as a source of growth into the future.
Clint Jasper reporting. If you want to read more about these expansions into China, just head to the RN homepage and you can find us under the programs tab. This is A Country Breakfast. Brett Worthington with you this morning. At the height of summer, when the conditions are right, up to 3,000 people, mainly Chinese tourists, make their way to a small coastal Victorian town of Venus Bay. They're there to harvest pippies on the beach, and locals aren't happy about it. Racial tensions have boiled over, allegations have flown around, and now marine biologists are attempting to bring some objectivity to this ongoing debate. ABC reporter Fiona Pepper visited Venus Bay to try and see what was at the heart of this debate.
My name is Chen Austin, and we are just for the pipi hunting, pipi picking.
How many times have you been pipi harvesting in Venus Bay?
Oh, this is the first time. We come here, we start in here, and it's the first time to come to Venus Bay and the first time to the pipi hunting.
And why did you want to come down?
Because it's famous. It's famous for people to visit.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we want to take a look of it.
Hello. So you guys local from Venus Bay?
No, we're up on Wonthaggi.
So you're getting pippies for bait?
Yes, yeah.
How often do you come and grab pippies?
The first time in 3 years, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, it's usually too many Asians here. So, yeah.
So you get frustrated with the amount of people getting pippies on this beach?
Yes, yep, definitely. Yeah.
Why is that?
There's nothing left. There's no big ones left, so yeah. Well, the last time I came was Christmas Day, and there's probably 3,000 ethnics down here, so yeah. It wasn't, I drove away because they fill the car park right back to the shops, and they're just everywhere. The whole beach is full.
I mean, do you think that's pretty typical for a beach in a, coastal town in the school holidays?
No, not really. No, they come every Christmas Day because parks aren't working. So they just bring everyone, so, yeah.
These two conversations pretty well sum up the situation between locals and visitors down at Venus Bay. Is this just a case of racism, or is it a small coastal community struggling to deal with an influx of city visitors? And what does it all mean for the pippi?
Illegal fishing is threatening Victoria's pippi colonies along the coastline in the state's east. Residents of Venus Bay on the South Gippsland coast are outraged, claiming some are flouting catch limits and even illegally selling the shellfish.
Channel 7 News reported in January 2012 that tensions were at a peak and that several people were convicted of illegal pippy harvesting. But since then, authorities have responded to concerns of overfishing. In Venus Bay, unlike the rest of Victoria, you can now only take 2 litres of pippies rather than 5. No tools like spades can be used, only hands or feet. Police and the Fisheries Department have also set up roadblocks during the busy period to search cars. In 2013, they found there was 90% compliance to the pippy bag limit. Dr. John Morangello is a lecturer of marine biology at the University of Melbourne, and he is now 1 year into a 3-year research project which is collecting data on the pippies at Venus Bay to see what impact harvesting has had on populations.
What we've found so far is that there are really good abundances of pippies in certain spots on the beach, but we're tending to find that around the access points there is less pippies available. Now, whether that's a seasonal pattern or actually is it a harvesting pattern, our research over the next 2 years will get the data coming in to really allow us to work out what's going on there and tease out this natural variation, because there are good years and bad years. You get years when there's lots of recruitment, that's when lots of little babies arrive to the beach. Good years for growth, good years for survival, but also just quite naturally bad years for all those different parameters. And then overlaying harvesting on top of it, it gets quite complex. So we really need good long-term data that we're generating and we've had the opportunity to do in this project to really get to the bottom of that.
I jump in the four-wheel drive with John and his 2 field assistants and visit a couple of the 18 survey points along the beach. The team goes back to the same spots each month to see how the pippy population is changing.
So this measuring tape here is what we call a transect, and it gives us a nice sort of standardised point of reference down the beach. And at every 10 to 20 metres, we're going to be taking some little samples of the sand in a sort of, take a small sort of bucket. We've got a special medieval torture device. It's called a cora. And we take a little sample of sand, that's a standardised amount of sand, and then we go and sort through that and count how many pippies that we've got in those samples, and we then replicate this along the beach.
Our next survey site is not far from the beach car park, where most of the harvesting takes place.
So we stopped at a site, you know, probably 3 kilometres down the beach?
Yeah, about that, yep.
And there was an abundance of pippies. You guys were collecting handfuls and handfuls, and now we've gotten a bit closer to the, you know, Beach One car park, and your surveys have pretty much drawn a blank. Do you think that's reflective of what the locals have to say?
I think so. I mean, I think this is what people observe. They're here coming and harvesting, and most people are fishing in this area, so they're not seeing many pippies when they're going and harvesting, and they're noticing that. I think the challenge is to try and explain what's actually driving that pattern. And I mean, I think a really legitimate hypothesis is that it's a harvesting effect, and there's also a number of other factors. And so you see it's been measuring these beach profiles at the moment. The beach here is actually a bit shallower than it is further away too. So pippies generally like a bit more of a steeper beach. So maybe there's some environmental effect going on there too. We've got to try and sort of tease these things apart, and it's difficult when you're dealing with these natural systems to work out what's going on. But definitely, you can see there's a lot less pippies here, and that's something to be concerned about, or something to try and understand at least anyway.
And with your background in marine biology, have you come across any sort of similar disputes going on within communities?
No, this is quite unique, Fiona, and I sort of stumbled across this when I was down here for a summer holiday with the family a few years ago, and just down on the beach like any marine biologist does when you're sort of watching people doing their things. And I went and Googled it when I got back to the holiday house and sort of found this whole debate going on. I haven't come across this before. People get very emotionally attached to their marine environments, but this one here is pretty special for Victoria, I think. Having people emotively connected to something like this is a really good thing, but also at the same time too, we need to make rational decisions on these things as well, and that's where hopefully science can play a role and bring a bit of objectivity into this.
John Morangello, ending that report from Fiona Pepper. If you'd like to hear more about that pippy harvest or check out some great photos down at Venus Bay, head to the RN homepage and look for A Country Breakfast. It's under the Programs tab. Thanks to Kerry Dell for technical production this week. I'm Brett Worthington. More great listening up next here on RN.